thought she was right. "Dear, unfortunate mistaken, Richard," said I. "When will he awake from his delusion?"
"He is not in the way to do so now, my dear," replied my guardian. "The more he suffers, the more averse he will be to me, having made me the principal representative of the great occasion of his suffering."
I could not help adding, "So unreasonably."
"Ah, Dame Trot, Dame Trot," returned my guardian, "what shall we find reasonable in Jarndyce and Jarndyce? Unreason and injustice at the top, unreason and injustice at the heart and at the bottom, unreason and injustice from beginning to end, if it ever has an end. How should poor Rick, always hovering near it, pluck reason out of it? He no more gathers grapes from thorns or figs from thistles than older men did in old times."
His gentleness and consideration for Richard whenever we spoke of him touched me so that I was always silent on this subject very soon.
"I suppose the Lord Chancellor and the Vice-Chancellors and the whole Chancery battery of great guns would be infinitely astonished by such unreason and injustice in one of their suitors," pursued my guardian. "When those learned gentlemen begin to raise moss roses from the powder they sow in their wigs, I shall begin to be astonished too."
He checked himself in glancing towards the window to look where the wind was, and leaned on the back of my chair instead.
"Well, well, little woman, to go on, my dear, this rock we must leave to time, chance, and hopeful circumstance. We must not shipwreck Ada upon it. She cannot afford, and he cannot afford, the remotest chance of another separation from a friend. Therefore I have particularly begged of Woodcourt, and I now particularly beg of you, my dear, not to move this subject with Rick. Let it rest. Next week, next month, next year, sooner or later, he will see me with clearer eyes. I can wait."
But I had already discussed it with him, I confessed, and so, I thought, had Mr. Woodcourt.
"So he tells me," returned my guardian. "Very good. He has made his protest, and Dame Durden has made hers, and there is nothing more to be said about it. Now I come to Mrs. Woodcourt. How do you like her, my dear?"
In answer to this question, which was oddly abrupt, I said I liked her very much, and thought she was more agreeable than she used to be.
"I think so, too," said my guardian. "Less pedigree? Not so much of Morgan Ap—what's-his-name?"
That was what I meant, I acknowledged, though he was a very harmless person, even when we had had more of him.
"Still, upon the whole, he is as well in his native mountains," said my guardian. "I agree with you." "Then, little woman, can I do better for a time than retain Mrs. Woodcourt here?"
"No, and yet—" My guardian looked at me, waiting for what I had to say. I had nothing to say. At least I had nothing in my mind that I could say. I had an undefined impression that it might have been better if we had had some other inmate, but I could hardly have explained why, even to myself, or if to myself, certainly not to anybody else.
"You see," said my guardian, "our neighbourhood is in Woodcourt's way, and he can come here to see her as often as he likes, which is agreeable to them both, and she is familiar to us and fond of you."
Yes, that was undeniable. I had nothing to say against it. I could not have suggested a better arrangement, but I was not quite easy in my mind. Esther, Esther, why not? Esther, think! "It is a very good plan indeed, dear guardian, and we could not do better."
"Sure, little woman?"
"Quite sure. I had had a moment's time to think. Since I had urged that duty on myself, I was quite sure."
"Good," said my guardian. "It shall be done. Carried unanimously."
"Carried unanimously," I repeated, going on with my work. It was a cover for his book table that I happened to be ornamenting. It had been laid by on the night preceding my sad journey and never resumed. I showed it to him now, and he admired it highly. After I had explained the pattern to him, and all the great effects that were to come out by and by, I thought I would go back to our last theme. "You said, dear guardian, when we spoke of Mr. Woodcourt before Ada left us, that you thought he would give a long trial to another country. Have you been advising him since?"
"Yes, little woman, pretty often."
"Has he decided to do so?"
"I rather think not."
"Some other prospect has opened to him, perhaps?" said I.
"Why, yes, perhaps," returned my guardian, beginning his answer in a very deliberate manner. "About half a year hence or so, there is a medical attendant for the poor to be appointed at a certain place in Yorkshire. It is a thriving place, pleasantly situated, streams and streets, town and country, mill and moor, and seems to present an opening for such a man. I mean a man whose hopes and aims may sometimes lie, as most men's sometimes do, I dare say, above the ordinary level, but to whom the ordinary level will be high enough, after all, if it should prove to be a way of usefulness and good service leading to no other. All generous spirits are ambitious, I suppose, but the ambition that calmly trusts itself to such a road, instead of spasmodically trying to fly over it, is of the kind I care for. It is Woodcourt's kind.
"And will he get this appointment?" I asked.
"Why, little woman," returned my guardian, smiling. "Not being an oracle, I cannot confidently say, but I think so. His reputation stands very high. There were people from that part of the country in the shipwreck, and, strange to say, I believe the best man has the best chance. You must not suppose it to be a fine endowment. It is a very, very commonplace affair, my dear, an appointment to a great amount of work and a small amount of pay. But better things will gather about it, it may be fairly hoped."
"The poor of that place will have reason to bless the choice, if it falls on Mr. Woodcourt, guardian."
"You are right, little woman. That I am sure they will."
We said no more about it, nor did he say a word about the future of Bleak House. But it was the first time I had taken my seat at his side in my morning dress, and that accounted for it, I considered. I now began to visit my dear girl every day in the dull, dark corner where she lived. The morning was my usual time, but whenever I found I had an hour or so to spare, I put on my bonnet and bustled off to Chancery Lane. They were both so glad to see me at all hours, and used to brighten up so when they heard me opening the door and coming in. Being quite at home, I never knocked, that I had no fear of becoming troublesome just yet. On these occasions I frequently found Richard absent. At other times he would be writing or reading papers in the cause of that table of his, so covered with papers which was never disturbed. Sometimes I would come upon him lingering at the door of Mr. Vholes's office. Sometimes I would meet him in the neighbourhood, lounging about and biting his nails. I often met him wandering in Lincoln's Inn, near the place where I had first seen him. Oh, how different! How different! That the money Ada brought him was melting away with the candles I used to see burning after dark in Mr. Vholes's office, I knew very well. It was not a large amount in the beginning. He had married in debt, and I could not fail to understand, by this time, what was meant by Mr. Vholes's shoulder being at the wheel, as I still heard it was. My dear made the best of housekeepers and tried hard to save, but I knew that they were getting poorer and poorer every day. She shone in the miserable corner like a beautiful star. She adorned and graced it so that it became another place, paler than she had been at home, and a little quieter than I had thought natural when she was yet so cheerful and hopeful. Her face was so unshadowed that I half believed she was blinded by her love for Richard to his ruinous career. I went one day to dine with them while I was under this impression. As I turned into Simmons Inn, I met little Miss Flight coming out. She had been to make a stately call upon the wards in Jarndyce, as she still called them, and had derived the highest gratification from that ceremony. Ada had already told me that she called every Monday at 5 o'clock, with one little extra white bow in her bonnet, which never appeared there at any other time, and with her largest reticule of documents on her arm.
"My dear," she began, "so delighted. How do you do? So glad to see you. And you are going to visit our interesting Jarndyce wards? To be sure. Our beauty is at home, my dear, and will be charmed to see you."
"Then Richard is not come in yet?" said I. "I am glad of that, for I was afraid of being a little late."
"No, he is not come in," returned Miss Flight. "He has had a long day in court. I left him there with Vholes. You don't like Vholes, I hope. Don't like Vholes. Dangerous man."
"I am afraid you see Richard oftener than ever now," said I.
"My dearest," returned Miss Flight, "daily and hourly. You know what I told you of the attraction on the Chancellor's table? My dear, next to myself, he is the most constant suitor in court. He begins quite to amuse our little party. Very friendly little party, are we not?"
It was miserable to hear this from her poor mad lips, though it was no surprise.
"In short, my valued friend," pursued Miss Flight, advancing her lips to my ear with an air of equal patronage and mystery, "I must tell you a secret. I have made him my executor, nominated, constituted, and appointed him, in my will, yes."
"Indeed?" said I.
"Yes," repeated Miss Flight, in her most genteel accents. "My executor, administrator, and assign. Our chancery phrases, my love. I have reflected that if I should wear out, he will be able to watch that judgment, being so very regular in his attendance."
It made me sigh to think of him.
"I did at one time mean," said Miss Flight, echoing the sigh, "'To nominate, constitute, and appoint poor Gridley. "'Also very regular, my charming girl. "'I assure you, most exemplary. "'But he wore out, poor man. "'So I have appointed his successor. "'Don't mention it. "'This is in confidence.'
"'She carefully opened her reticule a little way "'and showed me a folded piece of paper inside "'as the appointment of which she spoke.
"'Another secret, my dear. "'I have added to my collection of birds.'
"'Really, Miss Flight?' said I, knowing how it pleased her to have her confidence received with an appearance of interest. She nodded several times, and her face became overcast and gloomy.
"'Two more. I call them the wards in Jarndyce. They're caged up with all the others, with hope, joy, youth, peace, rest, life, dust, ashes, waste, want, ruin, despair, madness, death, cunning, folly, words, wigs, rags, sheepskin, plunder, precedent, jargon, gammon, and spinach.'
The poor soul kissed me with the most troubled look I had ever seen in her and went her way. Her manner of running over the names of her birds, as if she were afraid of hearing them even from her own lips, quite chilled me. This was not a cheering preparation for my visit, and I could have dispensed with the company of Mr. Vholes when Richard, who arrived within a minute or two after me, brought him to share our dinner. Although it was a very plain one, Ada and Richard were for some minutes both out of the room together, helping to get ready what we were to eat and drink. Mr. Vholes took that opportunity of holding a little conversation in a low voice with me. He came to the window where I was sitting and began upon Simmons Inn.
"'A dull place, Miss Summerson, for a life that is not an official one,' said Mr. Vholes, smearing the glass with his black glove to make it clearer for me.
"'There is not much to see here,' said I.
"'Nor to hear, miss,' returned Mr. Vholes. "'A little music does occasionally stray in, but we are not musical in the law and soon eject it. "'I hope Mr. Jarndyce is as well as his friends could wish him.'
"'I thanked Mr. Vholes and said he was quite well.
"'I have not the pleasure to be admitted among the number of his friends myself,' said Mr. Vholes, "'and I am aware that the gentlemen of our profession are sometimes regarded in such quarters with an unfavourable eye.' Our plain course, however, under good report and evil report, and all kinds of prejudice—we are the victims of prejudice—is to have everything openly carried on. How do you find Mr. C. looking, Miss Summerson?
He looks very ill, dreadfully anxious.
Just so, said Mr. Vholes.
He stood behind me with his long black figure reaching nearly to the ceiling of those low rooms, feeling the pimples on his face as if they were ornaments, and speaking inwardly and evenly, as though there were not a human passion or emotion in his nature.
"'Mr. Woodcourt is in attendance upon Mr. C., I believe,' he resumed.
"'Mr. Woodcourt is his disinterested friend,' I answered.
"'But I mean in professional attendance, medical attendance.'
"'That can do little for an unhappy mind,' said I.
"'Just so,' said Mr. Vholes.
So slow, so eager, so bloodless and gaunt, I felt as if Richard were wasting away beneath the eyes of this adviser, and there was something of the vampire in him.
"'Miss Summerson,' said Mr. Vholes, very slowly rubbing his gloved hands, as if, to his cold sense of touch, they were much the same in black kid or out of it, "'this was an ill-advised marriage of Mr. C.'s.'
I begged he would excuse me from discussing it. They had been engaged when they were both very young. I told him, a little indignantly, and when the prospect before them was much fairer and brighter. When Richard had not yielded himself to the unhappy influence which now darkened his life.
"'Just so,' assented Mr. Vholes again. "'Still, with a view to everything being openly carried on, I will, with your permission, Miss Summerson, observe to you that I consider this a very ill-advised marriage indeed. I owe the opinion not only to Mr. C.'s connections— against whom I should naturally wish to protect myself, but also to my own reputation. Dear to myself as a professional man, aiming to keep respectable, dear to my three girls at home for whom I am striving to realize some little independence, dear, I will even say, to my aged father, whom it is my privilege to support.
It would become a very different marriage, a much happier and better marriage. Another marriage altogether, Mr. Vholes, said I, if Richard were persuaded to turn his back on the fatal pursuit in which you are engaged with him. Mr. Vholes, with a noiseless cough, or rather gasp, into one of his black gloves, inclined his head as if he did not wholly dispute even that.
"'Miss Summerson,' he said, "'it may be so. and I freely admit that the young lady who has taken Mr. C.'s name upon herself in so ill-advised a manner— You will, I am sure, not quarrel with me for throwing out that remark again as a duty I owe to Mr. C.'s connections— is a highly genteel young lady. Business has prevented me from mixing much with general society in any but a professional character. Still, I trust I am competent to perceive that she is a highly genteel young lady. As to beauty, I am not a judge of that myself, and I never did give much attention to it from a boy, but I dare say the young lady is equally eligible in that point of view. She is considered so, I have heard, among the clerks in the inn, and it is a point more in their way than in mine, in reference to Mr. C.'s pursuit of his interests.
"Oh, his interests, Mr. Vholes."
"Pardon me," returned Mr. Vholes, going on in exactly the same inward and dispassionate manner. "Mr. C. takes certain interests under certain wills disputed in the suit. It is a term we use. In reference to Mr. C.'s pursuit of his interests, I mentioned to you, Miss Summerson, the first time I had the pleasure of seeing you, in my desire that everything should be openly carried out. I use those words, for I happened afterwards to note them in my diary, which is producible at any time. I mentioned to you that Mr. C. had laid down the principle of watching his own interests, and that when a client of mine laid down a principle which was not of an immoral, that is to say, unlawful nature, it devolved upon me to carry it out. I have carried it out. I do carry it out. But I will not smooth things over to any connection of Mr. C.'s on any account. As open as I was to Mr. Jarndyce, I am to you. I regard it in the light of a professional duty to be so, though it can be charged to no one. I openly say, unpalatable as it may be, that I consider Mr. C.'s affairs in a very bad way, that I consider Mr. C. himself in a very bad way, and that I regard this as an exceedingly ill-advised marriage. Am I here, sir? Yes, I thank you. I am here, Mr. C., and enjoying the pleasure of some agreeable conversation with Miss Summerson, for which I have to thank you very much, sir."
He broke off thus in answer to Richard, who addressed him as he came into the room. By this time I too well understood Mr. Vholes's scrupulous way of saving himself and his respectability, not to feel that our worst fears did but keep pace with his client's progress. We sat down to dinner, and I had an opportunity of observing Richard anxiously. I was not disturbed by Mr. Vholes, who took off his gloves to dine, though he sat opposite to me at the small table, for I doubt if, looking up at all, he once removed his eyes from his host's face. I found Richard thin and languid, slovenly in his dress, abstracted in his manner, forcing his spirits now and then, and at other intervals relapsing into a dull thoughtfulness. About his large bright eyes that used to be so merry, there was a wanness and a restlessness that changed them altogether. I cannot use the expression that he looked old. There is a ruin of youth which is not like age, and into such a ruin Richard's youth and youthful beauty had all fallen away. He ate little and seemed indifferent what it was, showed himself to be much more impatient than he used to be, and was quick even with Ada. I thought at first that his old light-hearted manner was all gone, but it shone out of him sometimes, as I had occasionally known little momentary glimpses of my own old face to look out upon me from the glass. His laugh had not quite left him either, but it was like the echo of a joyful sound, and that is always sorrowful. Yet he was as glad as ever, in his old affectionate way, to have me there, and we talked of the old times pleasantly. These did not appear to be interesting to Mr. Vholes, though he occasionally made a gasp, which I believe was his smile. He rose shortly after dinner, and said that with the permission of the ladies he would retire to his office.
"Always devoted to business, Vholes," cried Richard.
"Yes, Mr. C.," he returned. "The interests of clients are never to be neglected, sir. They are paramount in the thoughts of a professional man like myself, who wishes to preserve a good name among his fellow practitioners and society at large. My denying myself the pleasure of the present agreeable conversation may not be wholly irrespective of your own interests, Mr. C."
Richard expressed himself quite sure of that, and lighted Mr. Vholes out. On his return he told us more than once that Vholes was a good fellow, a safe fellow, a man who did what he pretended to do, a very good fellow indeed. He was so defiant about it that it struck me he had begun to doubt Mr. Vholes. Then he threw himself on the sofa, tired out, and Ada and I put things to rights, for they had no other servant than the woman who attended to the chambers.
My dear girl had a cottage piano there and quietly sat down to sing some of Richard's favourites, the lamp being first removed into the next room as he complained of its hurting his eyes. I sat between them at my dear girl's side and felt very melancholy listening to her sweet voice. I think Richard did too. I think he darkened the room for that reason. She had been singing some time, rising between whiles to bend over him and speak to him, when Mr. Woodcourt came in. Then he sat down by Richard, and half playfully, half earnestly, quite naturally and easily found out how he felt and where he had been all day. Presently he proposed to accompany him in a short walk on one of the bridges, as it was a moonlight, airy night, and Richard, readily consenting, they went out together. They left my dear girl still sitting at the piano, and me still sitting beside her. When they were gone out, I drew my arm round her waist. She put her left hand in mine. I was sitting on that side, but kept her right upon the keys, going over and over them without striking any note. "Esther, my dear," she said, breaking silence, "Richard is never so well, and I am never so easy about him as when he is with Alan Woodcourt. We have to thank you for that." I pointed out to my darling how this could scarcely be, because Mr. Woodcourt had come to her cousin John's house and had known us all there, and because he had always liked Richard, and Richard had always liked him, and so forth. "All true," said Ada, "but that he is such a devoted friend to us, we owe to you." I thought it best to let my dear girl have her way and to say no more about it, so I said as much. I said it lightly, because I felt her trembling. "Esther, my dearest, I want to be a good wife, a very, very good wife indeed. You shall teach me." "I teach?" I said no more, for I noticed the hand that was fluttering over the keys, and I knew that it was not I who ought to speak, that it was she who had something to say to me. "When I married Richard, I was not insensible to what was before him. I had been perfectly happy for a long time with you, and I had never known any trouble or anxiety, so loved and cared for, but I understood the danger he was in, dear Esther." I know, my darling. "When we were married, I had some little hope that I might be able to convince him of his mistake, that he might come to regard it in a new way as my husband, and not pursue it all the more desperately for my sake, as he does. But if I had not had that hope, I would have married him just the same, Esther, just the same." In the momentary firmness of the hand that was never still, a firmness inspired by the utterance of these last words and dying away with them, I saw the confirmation of her earnest tones. "You are not to think, my dearest Esther, that I fail to see what you see and fear what you fear. No one can understand him better than I do. The greatest wisdom that ever lived in the world could scarcely know Richard better than my love does." She spoke so modestly and softly, and her trembling hand expressed such agitation as it moved to and fro upon the silent notes. "My dear, dear girl. I see him at his worst every day. I watch him in his sleep. I know every change of his face. But when I married Richard, I was quite determined, Esther, if heaven would help me, never to show him that I grieved for what he did, and so to make him more unhappy. I want him, when he comes home, to find no trouble in my face. I want him, when he looks at me, to see what he loved in me. I married him to do this, and this supports me." I felt her trembling more. I waited for what was yet to come, and I now thought I began to know what it was. "And something else supports me, Esther." She stopped a minute. Stopped speaking only. Her hand was still in motion. "I look forward a little while, and I don't know what great aid may come to me. When Richard turns his eyes upon me then, there may be something lying on my breast more eloquent than I have been, with greater power than mine to show him his true course and win him back." Her hand stopped now. She clasped me in her arms, and I clasped her in mine. "If that little creature should fail too, Esther, I still look forward. I look forward a long while, through years and years, and think that then, when I am growing old, or when I am dead perhaps, a beautiful woman, his daughter, happily married, may be proud of him and a blessing to him. Or that a generous, brave man, as handsome as he used to be, as hopeful and far more happy, may walk in the sunshine with him, honouring his grey head and saying to himself, 'I thank God this is my father, ruined by a fatal inheritance and restored through me.' Oh, my sweet girl, what a heart was that which beat so fast against me! These hopes uphold me, my dear Esther, and I know they will, though sometimes even they depart from me before a dread that arises when I look at Richard.
I tried to cheer my darling, and asked her what it was. Sobbing and weeping, she replied, "That he may not live to see his child."
Chapter 61. A Discovery. The days when I frequented that miserable corner which my dear girl brightened can never fade in my remembrance. I never see it, and I never wish to see it now. I have been there only once since. But in my memory there is a mournful glory shining on the place which will shine forever. Not a day passed without my going there, of course. At first I found Mr. Skimpole there on two or three occasions, idly playing the piano and talking in his usual vivacious strain. Now, besides my very much mistrusting the probability of his being there without making Richard poorer, I felt as if there were something in his careless gaiety too inconsistent with what I knew of the depths of Ada's life. I clearly perceived, too, that Ada shared my feelings. I therefore resolved, after much thinking of it, to make a private visit to Mr. Skimpole and try delicately to explain myself. My dear girl was the great consideration that made me bold. I set off one morning, accompanied by Charlie, for Somerstown. As I approached the house, I was strongly inclined to turn back, for I felt what a desperate attempt it was to make an impression on Mr. Skimpole, and how extremely likely it was that he would signally defeat me. However, I thought that being there I would go through with it. I knocked with a trembling hand at Mr. Skimpole's door, literally with a hand, for the knocker was gone, and after a long parley gained admission from an Irishwoman who was in the area when I knocked, breaking up the lid of a water-butt with a poker to light the fire with. Mr. Skimpole, lying on the sofa in his room, playing the flute a little, was enchanted to see me. "Now, who should receive me?" he asked. "Who would I prefer for mistress of the ceremonies? Would I have his comedy daughter, his beauty daughter, or his sentiment daughter? Or would I have all the daughters at once, in a perfect nosegay?" I replied, half-defeated already, that I wished to speak to himself only, if he would give me leave. "My dear Miss Summerson, most joyfully, of course," he said, bringing his chair nearer mine and breaking into his fascinating smile. "Of course it's not business, then it's pleasure." I said it certainly was not business that I came upon, but it was not quite a pleasant matter. "Then, my dear Miss Summerson," said he, with the frankest gaiety, "don't allude to it. Why should you allude to anything that is not a pleasant matter? I never do. And you are a much pleasanter creature in every point of view than I. You are perfectly pleasant. I am imperfectly pleasant. Then, if I never allude to an unpleasant matter, how much less should you? So that's disposed of, and we will talk of something else." Although I was embarrassed, I took courage to intimate that I still wished to pursue the subject. "I should think it a mistake," said Mr. Skimpole, with his airy laugh, "if I thought Miss Summerson capable of making one, but I don't." "Mr. Skimpole," said I, raising my eyes to his, "I have so often heard you say that you are unacquainted with the common affairs of life."
"Meaning our three banking-house brothers, L.S. and who's the junior partner, D.?" said Mr. Skimpole, brightly. "Not an idea of them."
"That, perhaps," I went on, "you will excuse my boldness on that account. I think you ought most seriously to know that Richard is poorer than he was."
"Dear me," said Mr. Skimpole, "so am I, they tell me."
"And in very embarrassed circumstances."
"Parallel case, exactly,"
said Mr. Skimpole, with a delighted countenance. "This at present naturally causes Ada much secret anxiety, and as I think she is less anxious when no claims are made upon her by visitors, and as Richard has one uneasiness always heavy on his mind, it has occurred to me to take the liberty of saying that, if you would, not—" I was coming to the point with great difficulty, when he took me by both hands, and with a radiant face and in the liveliest way anticipated it.
"Not go there? Certainly not, my dear Miss Summerson, most assuredly not. Why should I go there? When I go anywhere, I go for pleasure. I don't go anywhere for pain, because I was made for pleasure. Pain comes to me when it wants me. Now, I have had very little pleasure at our dear Richard's lately, and your practical sagacity demonstrates why. Our young friends, losing the youthful poetry which was once so captivating in them, begin to think, 'This is a man who wants pounds.' So I am. I always want pounds. Not for myself, but because tradespeople always want them of me. Next, our young friends begin to think, becoming mercenary, 'This is the man who had pounds, who borrowed them,' which I did. I always borrow pounds. So our young friends, reduced to prose, which is much to be regretted, degenerate in their power of imparting pleasure to me. Why should I go to see them, therefore? Absurd!"
through the beaming smile with which he regarded me as he reasoned thus, there now broke forth a look of disinterested benevolence, quite astonishing. "Besides," he said, pursuing his argument in his tone of light-hearted conviction, "if I don't go anywhere for pain, which would be a perversion of the intention of my being and a monstrous thing to do, why should I go anywhere to be the cause of pain? If I went to see our young friends in their present ill-regulated state of mind, I should give them pain. The associations with me would be disagreeable. They might say, 'This is the man who had pounds and who can't pay pounds,' which I can't, of course. Nothing could be more out of the question. Then kindness requires that I shouldn't go near them, and I won't." He finished by genially kissing my hand and thanking me. "Nothing but Miss Summerson's fine tact," he said, "would have found this out for him." I was much disconcerted, but I reflected that if the main point were gained, it mattered little how strangely he perverted everything leading to it. I had determined to mention something else, however, and I thought I was not to be put off in that. "Mr. Skimpole," said I must take the liberty of saying before I conclude my visit that I was much surprised to learn, on the best authority some little time ago, that you knew with whom that poor boy left Bleak House, and that you accepted a present on that occasion. I have not mentioned it to my guardian, for I fear it would hurt him unnecessarily, but I may say to you that I was much surprised."
"No? Really surprised, my dear Miss Summerson?" he returned inquiringly, raising his pleasant eyebrows.
"Greatly surprised."
He thought about it for a little while, with a highly agreeable and whimsical expression of face, then quite gave it up, and said in his most engaging manner,
"You know what a child I am. Why surprised?"
I was reluctant to enter minutely into that question, but as he begged I would, for he was really curious to know, I gave him to understand in the gentlest words I could use that his conduct seemed to involve a disregard of several moral obligations. He was much amused and interested when he heard this, and said,
"No, really?"
with ingenuous simplicity.
"You know I don't intend to be responsible. I never could do it. Responsibility is a thing that has always been above me, or below me," said Mr. Skimpole. "I don't even know which. But as I understand the way in which my dear Miss Summerson, always remarkable for her practical good sense and clearness, puts this case, I should imagine it was chiefly a question of money, do you know?"
I incautiously gave a qualified assent to this.
"Ah, then you see," said Mr. Skimpole, shaking his head, "I am hopeless of understanding it."
I suggested, as I rose to go, that it was not right to betray my guardian's confidence for a bribe.
"My dear Miss Summerson," he returned with a candid hilarity that was all his own, "I can't be bribed."
"Not by Mr. Bucket?" said I.
"No," said he, "not by anybody. I don't attach any value to money. I don't care about it. I don't know about it. I don't want it. I don't keep it. It goes away from me directly. How can I be bribed?"
I showed that I was of a different opinion, though I had not the capacity for arguing the question.
"On the contrary," said Mr. Skimpole, "I'm exactly the man to be placed in a superior position in such a case as that. I'm above the rest of mankind in such a case as that. I can act with philosophy in such a case as that. I'm not warped by prejudices, as an Italian baby is by bandages. I am as free as the air. I feel myself as far above suspicion as Caesar's wife."
Anything to equal the lightness of his manner and the playful impartiality with which he seemed to convince himself, as he tossed the matter about like a ball of feathers, was surely never seen in anybody else.
"Observe the case, my dear Miss Summerson. Here is a boy received into the house and put to bed in a state that I strongly object to. The boy being in bed, a man arrives, like the house that Jack built. Here is the man who demands the boy who is received into the house and put to bed in a state that I strongly object to. Here is a banknote produced by the man who demands the boy who is received into the house and put to bed in a state that I strongly object to. Here is the Skimpole who accepts the banknote produced by the man who demands the boy who is received into the house and put to bed in a state that I strongly object to. Those are the facts." "Very well. Should the Skimpole have refused the note?" "Why should the Skimpole have refused the note?" Skimpole protests to Bucket, "What's this for? I don't understand it. It is of no use to me. Take it away." Bucket still entreats Skimpole to accept it. Are there reasons why Skimpole, not being warped by prejudices, should accept it? Yes. Skimpole perceives them. What are they? Skimpole reasons with himself, "This is a tamed lynx, an active police officer, an intelligent man, a person of a peculiarly directed energy and great subtlety both of conception and execution, who discovers our friends and enemies for us when they run away, recovers our property for us when we are robbed, avenges us comfortably when we are murdered. This active police officer and intelligent man has acquired, in the exercise of his art, a strong faith in money. He finds it very useful to him, and he makes it very useful to society. Shall I shake that faith in Bucket because I want it myself? Shall I deliberately blunt one of Bucket's weapons? Shall I positively paralyze Bucket in his next detective operation? And again, if it is blamable in Skimpole to take the note, it is blamable in Bucket to offer the note, much more blamable in Bucket because he is the knowing man. Now, Skimpole wishes to think well of Bucket. Skimpole deems it essential, in its little place, to the general cohesion of things, that he should think well of Bucket. The state expressly asks him to trust to Bucket, and he does. And that's all he does.
I had nothing to offer in reply to this exposition, and therefore took my leave. Mr. Skimpole, however, who was in excellent spirits, would not hear of my returning home attended only by little coavinces, and accompanied me himself. He entertained me on the way with a variety of delightful conversation, and assured me, at parting, that he should never forget the fine tact with which I had found that out for him about our young friends. As it so happened that I never saw Mr. Skimpole again, I may at once finish what I know of his history. A coolness arose between him and my guardian, based principally on the foregoing grounds and on his having heartlessly disregarded my guardian's entreaties, as we afterwards learned from Ada, in reference to Richard. His being heavily in my guardian's debt had nothing to do with their separation. He died some 5 years afterwards and left a diary behind him with letters and other materials towards his life, which was published, and which showed him to have been a victim of a combination on the part of mankind against an amiable child. It was considered very pleasant reading, but I never read more of it myself than the sentence on which I chanced to light on opening the book. It was this: "Jaundice, in common with most other men I have known, is the incarnation of selfishness." And now I come to a part of my story touching myself very nearly indeed, and for which I was quite unprepared when the circumstances occurred. Whatever little lingerings may have now and then revived in my mind associated with my poor old face had only revived as belonging to a part of my life that was gone, gone like my infancy or my childhood. I have suppressed none of my many weaknesses on that subject, but have written them as faithfully as my memory has recalled them. And I hope to do, and mean to do, the same down to the last words of these pages, which I see now not so very far before me. The months were gliding away, and my dear girl, sustained by the hopes she had confided in me, was the same beautiful star in the miserable corner. Richard, more worn and haggard, haunted the court day after day, listlessly sat there the whole day long when he knew there was no remote chance of the suit being mentioned, and became one of the stock sights of the place. I wonder whether any of the gentlemen remembered him as he was when he first went there. So completely was he absorbed in his fixed idea that he used to avow in his cheerful moments that he should never have breathed the fresh air now but for Woodcourt. It was only Mr. Woodcourt who could occasionally divert his attention for a few hours at a time, and rouse him even when he sunk into a lethargy of mind and body that alarmed us greatly, and the returns of which became more frequent as the months went on. My dear girl was right in saying that he only pursued his errors the more desperately for her sake. I have no idea that his desire to retrieve what he had lost was rendered the more intense by his grief for his young wife, and became like the madness of a gamester. I was there, as I have mentioned, at all hours. When I was there at night, I generally went home with Charlie in a coach. Sometimes my guardian would meet me in the neighbourhood, and we would walk home together. One evening he had arranged to meet me at 8 o'clock. I could not leave, as I usually did, quite punctually at the time, for I was working for my dear girl and had a few stitches more to do to finish what I was about. But it was within a few minutes of the hour when I bundled up my little work-basket, gave my darling my last kiss for the night, and hurried downstairs. Mr. Woodcourt went with me, as it was dusk. When we came to the usual place of meeting, it was close by and Mr. Woodcourt had often accompanied me before, my guardian was not there. We waited half an hour, walking up and down, but there were no signs of him. We agreed that he was either prevented from coming, or that he had come and gone away, and Mr. Woodcourt proposed to walk home with me. It was the first walk we had ever taken together, except that very short one to the usual place of meeting. We spoke of Richard and Ada the whole way. I did not thank him in words for what he had done,
My appreciation of it had risen above all words then, but I hoped he might not be without some understanding of what I felt so strongly. Arriving at home and going upstairs, we found that my guardian was out, and that Mrs. Woodcourt was out too. We were in the very same room into which I had brought my blushing girl when her youthful lover, now her so altered husband, was the choice of her young heart. The very same room from which my guardian and I had watched them going away through the sunlight in the fresh bloom of their hope and promise. We were standing by the opened window looking down into the street when Mr. Woodcourt spoke to me. I learned in a moment that he loved me. I learned in a moment that my scarred face was all unchanged to him. I learned in a moment that what I had thought was pity and compassion was devoted, generous, faithful love. Oh, too late to know it now, too late, too late. That was the first ungrateful thought I had, too late. "When I returned," he told me, "when I came back, no richer than when I went away, and found you newly risen from a sick bed, yet so inspired by sweet consideration for others, and so free from a selfish thought. Oh, Mr. Woodcourt, forbear, forbear," I entreated him. "I do not deserve your high praise. I had many selfish thoughts at that time, many." "Heaven knows, beloved of my life," said he, "that my praise is not a lover's praise, but the truth. You do not know what all around you see in Esther Summerson, how many hearts she touches and awakens, what sacred admiration and what love she wins." "Oh, Mr. Woodcourt," cried I, "it is a great thing to win love. It is a great thing to win love. I am proud of it and honoured by it, and the hearing of it causes me to shed these tears of mingled joy and sorrow, joy that I have won it, sorrow that I have not deserved it better, but I am not free to think of yours." I said it with a stronger heart, for when he praised me thus, and when I heard his voice thrill with his belief that what he said was true, I aspired to be more worthy of it. It was not too late for that. Although I closed this unforeseen page in my life tonight, I could be worthier of it all through my life. And it was a comfort to me, and an impulse to me, and I felt a dignity rise up within me that was derived from him when I thought so. He broke the silence. "I should poorly show the trust that I have in the dear one, who will evermore be as dear to me as now," and the deep earnestness with which he said it at once strengthened me and made me weep, "if, after her assurance that she is not free to think of my love, I urged it. Dear Esther, let me only tell you that the fond idea of you which I took abroad was exalted to the heavens when I came home. I have always hoped, in the first hour when I seemed to stand in any ray of good fortune, to tell you this. I have always feared that I should tell it you in vain. My hopes and fears are both fulfilled tonight. I distress you. I have said enough." Something seemed to pass into my place that was like the angel he thought me, and I felt so sorrowful for the loss he had sustained. I wished to help him in his trouble, as I had wished to do when he showed that first commiseration for me. "Dear Mr. Woodcourt," said I, "before we part tonight, something is left for me to say. I never could say it as I wish. I never shall, but—" I had to think again of being more deserving of his love and his affliction before I could go on. "I am deeply sensible of your generosity, and I shall treasure its remembrance to my dying hour. I know full well how changed I am. I know you are not unacquainted with my history, and I know what a noble love that is which is so faithful. What you have said to me could have affected me so much from no other lips, for there are none that could give it such a value to me. It shall not be lost. It shall make me better." He covered his eyes with his hand and turned away his head. How could I ever be worthy of those tears? If, in the unchanged intercourse we shall have together, intending Richard and Ada, and I hope in many happier scenes of life, you ever find anything in me which you can honestly think is better than it used to be, believe that it will have sprung up from tonight, and that I shall owe it to you. And never believe, dear, dear Mr. Woodcourt, never believe that I forget this night, or that while my heart beats it can be insensible to the pride and joy of having been beloved by you." He took my hand and kissed it. He was like himself again, and I felt still more encouraged. "I am induced by what you said just now," said I, "to hope that you have succeeded in your endeavour." "I have," he answered, "with such help from Mr. Jarndyce, as you who know him so well can imagine him to have rendered me, I have succeeded." "Heaven bless him for it," said I, giving him my hand, "and heaven bless you in all you do.
"I shall do it better for the wish," he answered. "It will make me enter on these new duties as on another sacred trust from you."
"Oh, Richard," I exclaimed involuntarily, "what will he do when you are gone?"
"I am not required to go yet. I would not desert him, dear Miss Summerson, even if I were." One other thing I felt it needful to touch upon before he left me. I knew that I should not be worthier of the love I could not take if I reserved it.
"Mr. Woodcourt," said I, "you will be glad to know from my lips, before I say good night, that in the future, which is clear and bright before me, I am most happy, most fortunate, have nothing to regret or desire."
It was indeed a glad hearing to him, he replied.
"From my childhood I have been," said I, "the object of the untiring goodness of the best of human beings, to whom I am so bound by every tie of attachment, gratitude, and love, that nothing I could do in the compass of a life could express the feelings of a single day."
"I share those feelings," he returned. "You speak of Mr. Jarndyce."
"You know his virtues well," said I, "but few can know the greatness of his character as I know it. All its highest and best qualities have been revealed to me in nothing more brightly than in the shaping out of that future in which I am so happy. And if your highest homage and respect had not been his already, which I know they are, they would have been his, I think, on this assurance, and in the feeling it would have awakened in you towards him for my sake."
He fervently replied that indeed, indeed, they would have been. I gave him my hand again.
"Good night," I said. "Good-bye."
"The first until we meet tomorrow, the second as a farewell to this theme between us forever."
"Yes."
"Good night. Good-bye."
He left me, and I stood at the dark window watching the street. His love, in all its constancy and generosity, had come so suddenly upon me that he had not left me a minute when my fortitude gave way again and the street was blotted out by my rushing tears. But they were not tears of regret and sorrow. No, he had called me the beloved of his life, and had said I would be evermore as dear to him as I was then. And I felt as if my heart would not hold the triumph of having heard those words. My first wild thought had died away. It was not too late to hear them, for it was not too late to be animated by them to be good, true, grateful, and contented. How easy my path! How much easier than his!
Chapter 62. Another Discovery. I had not the courage to see anyone that night. I had not even the courage to see myself, for I was afraid that my tears might a little reproach me. I went up to my room in the dark, and prayed in the dark, and lay down in the dark to sleep. I had no need of any light to read my guardian's letter by, for I knew it by heart. I took it from the place where I kept it, and repeated its contents by its own clear light of integrity and love, and went to sleep with it on my pillow. I was up very early in the morning, and called Charlie to come for a walk. We bought flowers for the breakfast table, and came back and arranged them, and were as busy as possible. We were so early that I had a good time still for Charlie's lesson before breakfast. Charlie, who was not in the least improved in the old defective article of grammar, came through it with great applause, and we were altogether very notable. When my guardian appeared, he said,
"Why, little woman, you look fresher than your flowers."
And Mrs. Woodcourt repeated and translated a passage from the Mewlin Willenwath, expressive of my being like a mountain with the sun upon it. This was all so pleasant that I hope it made me still more like the mountain than I had been before. After breakfast, I waited my opportunity and peeped about a little until I saw my guardian in his own room, the room of last night, by himself. Then I made an excuse to go in with my housekeeping keys, shutting the door after me.
"Well, Dame Durden?" said my guardian.
The post had brought him several letters, and he was writing.
"You want money?"
"No, indeed, I have plenty in hand."
"There never was such a Dame Durden," said my guardian, "for making money last."
He had laid down his pen, and leaned back in his chair looking at me. I have often spoken of his bright face, but I thought I had never seen it look so bright and good. There was a high happiness upon it which made me think, "He has been doing some great kindness this morning."
"There never was," said my guardian, musing as he smiled upon me, "such a Dame Durden for making money last."
He had never yet altered his old manner. I loved it, and him, so much, that when I now went up to him and took my usual chair, which was always put at his side,
for sometimes I read to him, and sometimes I talk to him, and sometimes I silently worked by him, I hardly liked to disturb it by laying my hand on his breast, but I found I did not disturb it at all. "Dear guardian," said I, "I want to speak to you. Have I been remiss in anything?"
"Remiss in anything, my dear?"
"Have I not been what I have meant to be since I brought the answer to your letter, guardian?"
"You have been everything I could desire, my love."
"I am very glad indeed to hear that," I returned. "You know, you said to me, 'Was this the mistress of Bleak House?' And I said, 'Yes.'"
"Yes,"
said my guardian, nodding his head. He had put his arm about me as if there were something to protect me from, and looked in my face, smiling. "Since then," said I, "we have never spoken on the subject, except once."
"And then I said Bleak House was thinning fast, and so it was, my dear."
"And I said," I timidly reminded him, "but its mistress remained." He still held me in the same protecting manner, and with the same bright goodness in his face. "Dear guardian," said I, "I know how you have felt all that has happened, and how considerate you have been. As so much time has passed, and as you spoke only this morning of my being so well again, perhaps you expect me to renew the subject. Perhaps I ought to do so. I will be the mistress of Bleak House when you please."
"See," he returned gaily, "what a sympathy there must be between us. I have had nothing else, poor Rick excepted, it's a large exception, in my mind. When you came in, I was full of it. When shall we give Bleak House its mistress, little woman?"
"When you please."
"Next month?"
"Next month, dear guardian."
"The day on which I take the happiest and best step of my life, the day on which I shall be a man more exulting and more enviable than any other man in the world, the day on which I give Bleak House its little mistress, shall be next month, then," said my guardian.
I put my arms round his neck and kissed him just as I had done on the day when I brought my answer. A servant came to the door to announce Mr. Bucket, which was quite unnecessary, for Mr. Bucket was already looking in over the servant's shoulder.
"Mr. Jarndyce and Miss Summerson," said he, rather out of breath, "with all apologies for intruding, will you allow me to order up a person that's on the stairs, and that objects to being left there in case of becoming the subject of observations in his absence? Thank you. Be so good as chair that there member in this direction, will you?" said Mr. Bucket, beckoning over the banisters.
This singular request produced an old man in a black skull-cap, unable to walk, who was carried up by a couple of bearers and deposited in the room near the door. Mr. Bucket immediately got rid of the bearers, mysteriously shut the door and bolted it.
"Now, you see, Mr. Jarndyce," he then began, putting down his hat and opening his subject with a flourish of his well-remembered finger, "you know me, and Miss Summerson knows me. This gentleman likewise knows me, and his name is Smallweed. The discounting line is his line principally, and he's what you may call a dealer in bills. That's about what you are, you know, ain't you?" said Mr. Bucket, stopping a little to address the gentleman in question, who was exceedingly suspicious of him. He seemed about to dispute this designation of himself when he was seized with a violent fit of coughing.
"Now, moral, you know," said Mr. Bucket, improving the accident, "don't you contradict when there ain't no occasion, and you won't be took in that way. Now, Mr. Jarndyce, I address myself to you. I've been negotiating with this gentleman on behalf of Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and one way and another I've been in and out and about his premises a deal. His premises are the premises formerly occupied by Crook, marine store dealer, a relation of this gentleman's that you saw in his lifetime, if I don't mistake."
My guardian replied, "Yes."
"Well, you are to understand," said Mr. Bucket, "that this gentleman, he come into Crook's property, and a good deal of magpie property there was, vast lots of waste paper among the rest. Lord bless you, of no use to nobody."
The cunning of Mr. Bucket's eye, and the masterly manner in which he contrived, without a look or a word against which his watchful auditor could protest, to let us know that he stated the case according to previous agreement, and could say much more of Mr. Smallweed if he thought it advisable, deprived us of any merit in quite understanding him. His difficulty was increased by Mr. Smallweed's being deaf as well as suspicious, and watching his face with the closest attention.
"Among them odd heaps of old papers, this gentleman, when he comes into the property, naturally begins to rummage, don't you see?" said Mr. Bucket.
"To which? Say that again,"
cried Mr. Smallweed, in a shrill, sharp voice.
"To rummage," repeated Mr. Bucket.
being a prudent man, and accustomed to take care of your own affairs, you begin to rummage among the papers as you have come into, don't you?"
"Of course I do,"
cried Mr. Smallweed. "Of course you do," said Mr. Bucket, conversationally. "And much to blame you would be if you didn't. So you chance to find, you know." Mr. Bucket went on, stooping over him with an air of cheerful raillery, which Mr. Smallweed by no means reciprocated. "And so you chance to find, you know, a paper with a signature of Jarndyce to it, don't you?" Mr. Smallweed glanced with a troubled eye at us, and grudgingly nodded assent. "And coming to look at that paper at your full leisure and convenience, all in good time, for you're not curious to read it, and why should you be? What do you find it to be but a will, you see? That's the drollery of it," said Mr. Bucket, with the same lively air of recalling a joke for the enjoyment of Mr. Smallweed, who still had the same crestfallen appearance of not enjoying it at all. "What do you find it to be but a will?" "I don't know that it's good as a will or as anything else," snarled Mr. Smallweed. Mr. Bucket eyed the old man for a moment. He had slipped and shrunk down in his chair into a mere bundle, as if he were much disposed to pounce upon him. Nevertheless, he continued to bend over him with the same agreeable air, keeping the corner of one of his eyes upon us. "Notwithstanding which," said Mr. Bucket, "you get a little doubtful and uncomfortable in your mind about it, having a very tender mind of your own."
"Eh? What do you say I've got of my own?"
asked Mr. Smallweed, with his hand to his ear.
"A very tender mind."
"Oh, well, go on," said Mr. Smallweed.
"And as you've heard a good deal mentioned regarding a celebrated Chancery will case of the same name, and as you know what a card Crook was for buying all manner of old pieces of furniture and books and papers and what not, and never liking to part with them, and always a-going to teach himself to read, you begin to think, and you never was more correct in your born days, ecod, if I don't look about me, I may get into trouble regarding this will."
"Now mind how you put it, Bucket,"
cried the old man anxiously, with his hand at his ear.
"Speak up, none of your brimstone tricks. Pick me up, I want to hear better. Oh, Lord, I'm shaken to bits."
Mr. Bucket had certainly picked him up at a dart. However, as soon as he could be heard through Mr. Smallweed's coughing and vicious ejaculations of,
"Oh, my bones, oh dear, I've no breath in my body, I'm worse than the chattering, clattering brimstone pig at home,"
Mr. Bucket proceeded in the same convivial manner as before.
"So, as I happen to be in the habit of coming about your premises, you take me into your confidence, don't you?"
I think it would be impossible to make an admission with more ill will and a worse grace than Mr. Smallweed displayed when he admitted this, rendering it perfectly evident that Mr. Bucket was the very last person he would have thought of taking into his confidence if he could, by any possibility, have kept him out of it.
"And I'll go into the business with you. Very pleasant we are over it, and I confirm you in your well-founded fears that you will get yourself into a most precious line if you don't come out with that there will," said Mr. Bucket emphatically. "And accordingly you arrange with me that it shall be delivered up to this present Mr. Jarndyce on no conditions. If it should prove to be valuable, you trusting yourself to him for your reward. That's about where it is, ain't it?"
"That's what was agreed,"
Mr. Smallweed assented, with the same bad grace.
"In consequence of which," said Mr. Bucket, dismissing his agreeable manner all at once and becoming strictly businesslike, "you've got that will upon your person at the present time, and the only thing that remains for you to do is just to get out with it."
Having given us one glance out of the watching corner of his eye, and having given his nose one triumphant rub with his forefinger, Mr. Bucket stood with his eyes fastened on his confidential friend, and his hand stretched forth ready to take the paper and present it to my guardian. It was not produced without much reluctance and many declarations on the part of Mr. Smallweed that he was a poor industrious man, and that he left it to Mr. Jarndyce's honour not to let him lose by his honesty. Little by little, he very slowly took from a breast pocket a stained, discoloured paper which was much singed upon the outside and a little burnt at the edges, as if it had long ago been thrown upon a fire and hastily snatched off again. Mr. Bucket lost no time in transferring this paper, with the dexterity of a conjurer, from Mr. Smallweed to Mr. Jarndyce. As he gave it to my guardian, he whispered behind his fingers,
"Hadn't settled how to make their market of it. Quarrelled and hinted about it. I laid out £20 upon it. First the avaricious grandchildren split upon him on account of their objections to his living so unreasonably long, and then they split on one another. Lord, there ain't one of the family that wouldn't sell the other for a pound or two, except the old lady, and she's only out of it because she's too weak in her mind to drive a bargain."
"Mr. Bucket," said my guardian aloud, Whatever the worth of this paper may be to anyone, my obligations are great to you. And if it be of any worth, I hold myself bound to see Mr. Smallweed remunerated accordingly.
Not according to your merits, you know, said Mr. Bucket, in friendly explanation to Mr. Smallweed. Don't you be afraid of that. According to its value.
That is what I mean, said my guardian. You may observe, Mr. Bucket, that I abstain from examining this paper myself. The plain truth is, I have forsworn and abjured the whole business these many years, and my soul is sick of it. But Miss Summerson and I will immediately place the paper in the hands of my solicitor in the cause, and its existence shall be made known without delay to all other parties interested.
Mr. Jarndyce can't say fairer than that, you understand, observed Mr. Bucket to his fellow visitor. And it being now made clear to you that nobody's a-going to be wronged, which must be a great relief to your mind, we may proceed with a ceremony of cheering you home again.
He unbolted the door, called in the bearers, wished us good morning, and with a look full of meaning and a crook of his finger at parting, went his way. We went our way too, which was to Lincoln's Inn, as quickly as possible. Mr. Kenge was disengaged, and we found him at his table in his dusty room with the inexpressive-looking books and the piles of papers. Chairs having been placed for us by Mr. Guppy, Mr. Kenge expressed the surprise and gratification he felt at the unusual sight of Mr. Jarndyce in his office. He turned over his double eyeglass as he spoke, and was more conversation Kenge than ever.
"I hope," said Mr. Kenge, "that the genial influence of Miss Summerson," he bowed to me, "may have induced Mr. Jarndyce," he bowed to him, "to forego some little of his animosity towards a cause and towards a court which are, shall I say, which take their place in the stately vista of the pillars of our profession."
"I am inclined to think," returned my guardian, "that Miss Summerson has seen too much of the effects of the court and the cause to exert any influence in their favour. Nevertheless, they are a part of the occasion of my being here. Mr. Kenge, before I lay this paper on your desk and have done with it, let me tell you how it has come into my hands."
He did so shortly and distinctly.
"It could not, sir," said Mr. Kenge, "have been stated more plainly and to the purpose if it had been a case at law."
"Did you ever know English law or equity either, plain and to the purpose?" said my guardian.
"Oh, fie!" said Mr. Kenge.
At first he had not seemed to attach much importance to the paper, but when he saw it he appeared more interested, and when he had opened and read a little of it through his eyeglass he became amazed.
"Mr. Jarndyce," he said, looking off it, "you have perused this?"
"Not I," returned my guardian.
"But, my dear sir," said Mr. Kenge, "it is a will of later date than any in the suit. It appears to be all in the testator's handwriting. It is duly executed and attested, and even if intended to be cancelled, as might possibly be supposed to be denoted by these marks of fire, it is not cancelled. Here it is, a perfect instrument."
"Well," said my guardian, "what is that to me?"
"Mr. Guppy," cried Mr. Kenge, raising his voice, "I beg your pardon, Mr. Jarndyce."
"Sir?"
"Mr. Vholes of Simmons Inn. My compliments. Jarndyce and Jarndyce. Glad to speak with him."
Mr. Guppy disappeared.
"You ask me what is this to you, Mr. Jarndyce. If you had perused this document, you would have seen that it reduces your interest considerably, though still leaving it a very handsome one, still leaving it a very handsome one," said Mr. Kenge, waving his hand persuasively and blandly. "You would further have seen that the interests of Mr. Richard Carstone and of Miss Ada Clare, now Mrs. Richard Carstone, are very materially advanced by it."
"Kenge," said my guardian, "if all the flourishing wealth that the suit brought into this vile court of chancery could fall to my two young cousins, I should be well contented. But do you ask me to believe that any good is to come of Jarndyce and Jarndyce?"
"Oh, really, Mr. Jarndyce, prejudice, prejudice. My dear sir, this is a very great country, a very great country. Its system of equity is a very great system, a very great system. Really, really."
My guardian said no more, and Mr. Vholes arrived. He was modestly impressed by Mr. Kenge's professional eminence.
"How do you do, Mr. Vholes? Will you be so good as to take a chair here by me, and look over this paper?"
Mr. Vholes did as he was asked, and seemed to read it every word. He was not excited by it, but he was not excited by anything. When he had well examined it, he retired with Mr. Kenge into a window, and shading his mouth with his black glove, spoke to him at some length. I was not surprised to observe Mr. Kenge inclined to dispute what he said before he had said much, for I knew that no two people ever did agree about anything in Jarndyce and Jarndyce. but he seemed to get the better of Mr. Kenge, too, in a conversation that sounded as if it were almost composed of the words Receiver General, Accountant General, Report, Estate, and Costs. When they had finished, they came back to Mr. Kenge's table and spoke aloud.
"Well, but this is a very remarkable document, Mr. Vholes," said Mr. Kenge.
Mr. Vholes said, "Very much so."
"And a very important document, Mr. Vholes," said Mr. Kenge. Again Mr. Vholes said,
"Very much so."
"And as you say, Mr. Vholes, when the cause is in the paper next term, this document will be an unexpected and interesting feature in it," said Mr. Kenge, looking loftily at my guardian.
Mr. Vholes was gratified, as a smaller practitioner striving to keep respectable, to be confirmed in any opinion of his own by such an authority.
"And when?" asked my guardian, rising after a pause, during which Mr. Kenge had rattled his money and Mr. Vholes had picked his pimples. "When is next term?"
"Next term, Mr. Jarndyce, will be next month," said Mr. Kenge. "Of course we shall at once proceed to do what is necessary with this document, and to collect the necessary evidence concerning it, and of course you will receive our usual notification of the cause being in the paper."
"To which I shall pay, of course, my usual attention."
"Still bent, my dear sir," said Mr. Kenge, showing us through the outer office to the door. "Still bent, even with your enlarged mind, on echoing a popular prejudice? We are a prosperous community, Mr. Jarndyce, a very prosperous community. We are a great country, Mr. Jarndyce. We are a very great country. This is a great system, Mr. Jarndyce. And would you wish a great country to have a little system? Now, really, really."
He said this at the stairhead, gently moving his right hand, as if it were a silver trowel with which to spread the cement of his words on the structure of the system, and consolidate it for a thousand ages. Chapter 63. Steel and Iron. George's shooting gallery is to let, and the stock is sold off. And George himself is at Chesney Wold attending on Sir Leicester in his rides, and riding very near his bridle rein because of the uncertain hand with which he guides his horse. But not today is George so occupied. He is journeying today into the iron country farther north to look about him. As he comes into the iron country farther north, such fresh green woods as those of Chesney Wold are left behind, and coal pits and ashes, high chimneys and red bricks, blighted verdure, scorching fires, and a heavy, never-lightening cloud of smoke become the features of the scenery. Among such objects rides the trooper, looking about him and always looking for something he has come to find. At last, on the black canal bridge of a busy town, with a clang of iron in it, and more fires and more smoke than he has yet seen, the trooper, swart with the dust of the coal roads, checks his horse, and asks a workman does he know the name of Rouncewell thereabouts.
"Why, master," quoth the workman, "do I know my own name?"
"'Tis so well known here, is it, comrade?"
asks the trooper. "Rouncewell's? Ah, you're right."
"And where might it be now?"
asks the trooper with a glance before him.
"The bank, the factory, or the house?"
the workman wants to know.
"Hum! Rouncewell's is so great, apparently,"
mutters the trooper, stroking his chin,
"that I have as good as half a mind to go back again. Why, I don't know which I want. Shall I find Mr. Rouncewell at the factory, do you think?"
"'Tain't easy to say where you'd find him. At this time of the day you might find either him or his son there, if he's in town. But his contracts take him away."
"And which is the factory?" "Why, he sees those chimneys? The tallest ones?" "Yes, he sees them. Well, let him keep his eye on those chimneys, going on as straight as ever he can, and presently he'll see him down a turning on the left, shut in by a great brick wall which forms one side of the street. That's Rouncewell's." The trooper thanks his informant and rides slowly on, looking about him. He does not turn back, but puts up his horse, and is much disposed to groom him too, at a public house, where some of Rouncewell's hands are dining, as the ostler tells him. Some of Rouncewell's hands have just knocked off for dinner-time, and seem to be invading the whole town. They are very sinewy and strong, are Rouncewell's hands. A little sooty, too. He comes to a gateway in the brick wall, looks in, and sees a great perplexity of iron lying about in every stage, and in a vast variety of shapes. In bars, in wedges, in sheets, in tanks, in boilers, in axles, in wheels, in cogs, in cranks, in rails, twisted and wrenched into eccentric and perverse forms as separate parts of machinery, mountains of it broken up and rusty in its age.
distant furnaces of it glowing and bubbling in its youth, bright fireworks of it showering about under the blows of the steam hammer, red-hot iron, white-hot iron, cold-black iron, an iron taste, an iron smell, and a babel of iron sounds.
"This is a place to make a man's head ache, too," says the trooper, looking about him for a counting-house. "Who comes here? This is very like me before I was set up. This ought to be my nephew, if likenesses run in families. Your servant, sir."
"Yours, sir. Are you looking for anyone?"
"Excuse me. Young Mr. Rouncewell, I believe."
"Yes."
"I was looking for your father, sir. I wish to have a word with him."
The young man, telling him he is fortunate in his choice of a time, for his father is there, leads the way to the office where he is to be found.
"Very like me before I was set up. Devilish like me,"
thinks the trooper as he follows. They come to a building in the yard with an office on an upper floor. At sight of the gentleman in the office, Mr. George turns very red.
"What name shall I say to my father?" asks the young man.